at South Korea, Marilyn Monroe. Rosenberg's H-bomb, Sugar Ray, Panmunjom, Randall, the King and I, and the catcher in the rye. Eisenhower vaccine, England's got a new queen, Marciano, Liberace, Santa.
Here. And looks like we're in the middle of it, particularly those activists at the City Council Coffee Clatch, which is continuing on a kind of an informal, haphazard basis. Every day at 10 o'clock, every business day at City Council, people are invited to come down and express their concerns about the sleeping ban or other city issues that affect homeless people. Mainly the focus has been on the complete shelter deficiency this winter in terms of no increased shelter at all for homeless people outside. That's less than 160 spaces for more than 1,300 homeless people. Kind of hard to cram everybody in there. Mayor Tim should recognize that, but Mayor Tim doesn't apparently, or feels powerless to deal with it. And we're going to actually be reading a transcript of Tim's political position on the sleeping ban as conveyed to a group of children and two teachers about 3 weeks ago. Apparently the students recorded the conversation as a class project with the mayor's permission, and now we're going to give the community the benefit of the mayor's wisdom. That's going to be happening later today on this January 7th, 2001 edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. But before that, let me remind you that you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Robert Norris. We'll be with you for 2.5 hours. If you want to call in, we have open lines, and that's 427-3772. If you want to reach HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization I work with and is concerned with these civil liberties issues and a broader range of them, actually, on a daily basis. You can give a call to 423-4833 and talk to someone off air. If you want to get to Free Radio Santa Cruz's voicemail, perhaps you have a public service announcement of your own, or you're interested in joining the collective, making a donation, getting more information about the station, learning how to receive the station on the web, give a call to 427-4523. All local numbers and numbers that are accessible, and the way we hope this radio station is accessible to the entire community, no exceptions. Call us up. This is free radio here, free speech radio. This is your radio. So again, 427-3772 is the number to call for the next 2.5 hours during my show. Going to be covering a number of topics, including, and of course, focusing on, to some extent, the sleeping ban, as we often do right before the city council meets. The city council is meeting on Tuesday, 2 days down the line. Of course, there's nothing, absolutely nothing on the agenda, either about the sleeping ban, about the shelter situation, about putting the long-missing porta-potties and dumpsters into the industrial zone so that there's some sort of semblance of dignity and sanitation for folks who are out there, even if they can't legally sleep, even if it's still a crime, actually a crime, of course, against the Geneva Convention, since sleep deprivation is a form of torture, since the UN Declaration of Human Rights guarantees people certain basic rights. One would think the Constitution, and indeed in some areas it does, guarantees people these rights. Sleeping bans have been overturned in Austin, Texas, Portland, Oregon, Miami, Florida, but not in progressive Santa Cruz, where the mayor, Tim Fitzmaurice, an alleged Green Party member who supposedly was elected with their support, who knew that they have endorsed statewide abolition of sleeping bans, who was told that the Greens, as a condition of their endorsing city council members this term, such as Ed Porter, demanded that those council members commit themselves to ending the sleeping ban. And of course, Ed Porter and Tim Fitzmaurice have said absolutely nothing about ending the sleeping ban since they got on the council in any public capacity. They won't put anything on the agenda, and we are essentially stuck where we've been for the last decade with the community to do the work that these elected pan-gen drums are supposed to be doing. And, of course, that is our work. Their phone number, in case you wish to give them a call at the city council, is 420-5017. I'm going to ask my producer to contact Tim Fitzmaurice because I think Tim should know that we are going to be reading his statement over the air, and he should have an opportunity to reply to it to the community, since he seems to want to shut down free speech at City Hall. You may know, if you followed this show closely, that, or just read the newspapers, that Fitzmaurice secured an injunction against me, a restraining order, as well as two other peaceful activists who have been conducting the City Council Coffee Clatch and Tag Team Teach-In, which essentially is a way, kind of a cute way of saying we sat during the business hours, actually during a part of the business hours, waiting to talk to council members in the public seats reserved for that purpose, for people who want to make appointments with council members, examine City Council documents, and engage in other public business, which supposedly our city council is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be actively interacting with the community and engaging in these kinds of activities, not meeting in closed session behind closed doors, not keeping important items off the agenda, but actually doing the work that they're being paid to do. And you do pay them, not a lot. I think you pay them $1,000 a year and $2,000 for the mayor. But we pay, of course, in a much higher price, both in terms of money, police arrests, medical emergencies, and also in terms of conscience. The hurt that happens to our social fabric, the hurt that happens to our social conscience when we realize that this is a city where the actual act of sleeping after 11 o'clock at night under Municipal Code 6.36.010A is itself a crime, an infraction crime, a $54 crime, which becomes a $272 crime if the individual does not appear in court to pay money he does not have. So it's not just a problem or a dilemma or a difficulty or a troubling issue or something that, as Emily Riley said, good people of conscience no doubt are working on. No. It is a basic human rights violation and an obscenity that is going on in our community. And it's not the only one. I mean, look at the rents. There's plenty of other problems we have in town, but if this city will not deal with that basic issue, the right of homeless people to sleep, then how can you expect these, and I say it as I said it in the Mercury News, gutless council members to deal with any issues and any upfront and publicly participatory way in any timely manner. You just can't, it's not going to happen. It hasn't happened. We saw the destruction of the medical marijuana club last year, the cannabis club, because the city attorney apparently rules the roost here. The city attorney said, I will prosecute Kate Wells' cannabis club because the mayor and the new mayor, Fitzmaurice, refused to hold an emergency session. I see we have a caller. Hi, caller.
Robert Norris, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bob LaMonica.
I had a couple of quick questions here. They're very, very brief, but
sure.
I thought they might be both.
Should I say Mr. Bob Rent Control LaMonica?
You can say that, most certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of questions about yourself. First one, are you a...
I didn't do it.
Are you a team player?
Hey, man, that's been asked a number of times. It depends on which team we're talking. I certainly was a member of the tag team that did the coffee clutch.
Good response. That's excellent. Are you a disruptive force?
I like to disrupt injustice, but I would say that I'm afraid that I'm frequently not disruptive enough. I tend to try to give politicians, to some extent, the benefit of the doubt. I'm outspoken, but, for example, at city council meetings, I don't stand up and make speeches at times when I'm not supposed to. I don't interrupt other speakers and stop them from speaking. I don't, engage in peaceful civil disobedience on a general, day-by-day basis or even meeting-by-meeting basis. Occasionally, in the past, in a group of people, I have done CD actions at city council that when there was no way to get items on the agenda otherwise, and they actually had some impact, such as our, what was it called, the sleep-ins, the lie-in we had in April, and the Pie and the Pusser Award, which actually wasn't even civil disobedience, just a form of legal street theater brought into the amusement of the entire community.
I got two others, and thank you for letting me get on the air. They're all about credibility.
Sure.
And what people claim credibility is about out there. Do you lack of public service activity?
Well, I consider this kind of radio show, I consider our putting ourselves up for legal vulnerability with these ridiculous restraining orders we're going to be answering Wednesday morning at 8:30 in Department 7 at the about the city council offices. I consider that and actions to bring police misconduct to public attention a form of public service, and some people might call it public disservice, but I would dispute that with them.
Last question. Do losers have the luxury of being honest?
I think everybody has the luxury of being honest, particularly winners. I mean, I think, these city council members have for months told us that they couldn't really come clean on the sleeping ban and talk about the human rights issues because they would lose the election. Well, you have a supermajority of the so-called progressives, all the city council except two is scan endorsed, and they've won. They have a supermajority. They can actually fire the city manager, fire the city attorney, and change the entire structure of the city if they want. Will they even discuss this? Or will they even discuss, moderately increasing shelter for homeless people in freezing weather? The answer is no, because they don't want to talk about an issue that Tim Fitzmaurice, and you'll learn this later because I'm going to be reading a transcript of what he said to a group of students, is afraid that it was a political failure last summer, so therefore he doesn't want to take it any further. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, and thanks for letting me get out there. I'll listen attentively to your show.
Any updates on rent control events coming up?
Not that I know of, and we'll have to see. Certainly there's things heating up in Santa Cruz with De Anza Mobile Home Park. And a lawsuit by the owners that's an attempt to threaten rent control mobile home rent control here in Santa Cruz. There's a good article in the Sentinel today about De Anza.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it interesting that people will accept to some degree mobile home park rent control because we generally perceive that it has to do with the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to the rest of us, though, we're left to the wiles of the Wild West real estate market here in Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in time, we might be able to get into it in detail. Rent control is very easily rationalized, in my opinion. It's regulation, just like we regulate everything else. And if we don't regulate it, we subsidize it.
Mm-hmm. Where can people go on the web if they want more information on rent control?
I think the best single site that I'm aware of is smrr.org. That's Santa Monicans for Renters' Rights. And from there, you can surf everywhere.
smrr.org. Huh?
What there is not yet that I would like to see happen also would be a rent control website that would be an information source, a portal for rent control. I think that something might be breaking this year. We'll see over the hill. I want to stay in touch with the folks that we made contact with in mid-December. I think that was the first time that I've seen any kind of a real uprising on this issue of any significance anywhere.
That was
maybe
over
in the
San
last
Jose
15 years. Right.
When you had a large forum over there.
Right. At the same token, this remains one of them incredibly hot potato issues that are very provocative, and you will rarely, if ever, see elected politicians trumpeted without a substantial bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
What I will say today is that how can those politicians that do agree with mobile rent control, mobile home rent control, deny the validity of rent control for the rest of the citizenry in dire need?
Well, maybe you want to keep that elderly constituency that's already backing SCAN candidates and not antagonize the rest of the business community.
Self-interest plays in a lot of things, and it certainly plays in the De Anza mobile home park residents' desire to maintain rent control, those that have it. And some of those are activists that are fairly well-known that live over there. And I would like to see them justify, if they do, their position on not coming out public for rent control for the rest of us.
Hear you.
Robert, thank you very much.
Hey.
All right, talk to you later.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye.
A lot of good questions from Bob LaMonica. I didn't pay him to call in, but he calls in anyway, and sometimes he calls me out. He's not always uniformly long-suffering with me. He's been quite critical at different times and properly, well, perhaps improperly so, or whatever. We disagree, but on this issue and the issues he brings up today, of course, I think we're pretty much unanimously in agreement, or 100% in agreement anyway. There are a couple meetings coming up that these issues might be brought up at. For instance, there's, of course, a city council meeting coming up on Tuesday. There's one at 3, the normal business meeting, from which I'm barred, by the way, because the concern is that I might harass a secretary in the offices of the city council members, which, of course, is in another building entirely than the city council chambers, where the 3 o'clock Tuesday meeting happens, but I will not be allowed to even come within 50 yards of that building. This is, of course, without a hearing. This is without any consideration of the First Amendment issues involved. This was actually a blatantly illegal order, which the Supreme Court, for example, looked at a similar order in 1968 where free speech was at issue and said, you can't do this without a hearing. So because of the form of the order, they didn't call us and say, hey, we're going to have a hearing on this, let's have a hearing. Instead, they simply issued the order and they announced the hearing afterward. That's okay if you're dealing with a stalker, if they could show violence or threats of violence or no free speech issues involved, but no, none of that was involved. So we see again this pattern of illegal behavior by the mayor and the city council acting through the city attorney, and this time using the cat's paw of an administrative assistant, Anna Brooks. And again, I'm kind of wandering from the topic, which is what meetings are coming, and that's the city council meeting, 3 o'clock on Tuesday, day after tomorrow. And there's a very interesting proclamation going to be made about World Religion Day. And I'm going to talk about that. And there's actually some interesting correspondence between a rabbi who journalist Becky Johnson got in touch with. She also is barred by this injunction from going to the 3 o'clock session, so she can't talk about it there. And he contacted the mayor, and the mayor gave him his view of events. And we're going to read that, too, on the air. We have an incoming call. Or we did have an incoming call. Call back, caller. Hi there, you're on free radio.
Hi, Robert, that was me. I thought you were going to proceed with a reading, and I didn't want to interrupt you.
No problem.
I just want to talk about two things. One of them is regarding the injunction hearing that you're having on Wednesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how prepared you are or what you plan on doing, but I think a good idea, whether or not you have an attorney, yourself be prepared. Go to the law library and research the laws protecting you from protecting your activities and the numbers, and know them well and cite them.
Right. You know, this is good advice, and I want you to tell us more because I think, you know, this would be appropriate for other people to learn too. But we do have actually 2 attorneys who volunteered in this one case pro bono, so we're fortunate here.
Wonderful. And, yeah. and know their position well and make sure that they go in there representing what you want represented, because this can be turned around to be a perfect opportunity to bring before the courts actually how your rights are being violated, and stay focused on what's happening right there. I mean, you may be able to bring in, this is a pattern. You know, we're going there to be heard just like any citizen can be heard. And we don't know if they do this to other citizens and other issues, but in this issue with this citizen, it's been a pattern. And you can cite that you have a Brown Act violation lawsuit against them for the same kinds of activities, and that you will consider a lawsuit against them for the violations against you here as a citizen. Use this as your chance to have a voice. Don't go in there with the attitude that you're a loser and that they're stacked against you. It's on the judge's conscience if he doesn't see it right, and you always have opportunities to appeal it.
Right, I think that's good advice, and it should be pointed out, however, that the amount of energy and time that we've already spent, I don't know, probably 100 hours on this lawsuit already, we actually have to record 2 copies of every tape we made. We made like 20-25 hours of tape because we had to tape everything that happened in the office in order to demonstrate that we weren't being disruptive.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, well, we don't have all the tapes because we are...
But you only need a sampling. You don't want to inundate the judge.
Right.
You don't want to overload him because
right.
he's human, but, and then they start,
sure.
they turn off.
The point, though, I'm making is that, and I appreciate the legal advice, which I'd encourage you, by the way, to give to my producer.
Oh, will do.
You should really talk to her directly off air. But people on who are listening to this show should know that the lobbying that might have gone into ending the sleeping ban and putting this item on the agenda, because we do have this council meeting on Tuesday, has been sidetracked into judicial stuff.
Yes.
Has been sidetracked into court action.
Well, you know...
And that's what we call a slap suit, a strategic lawsuit against
public
participation.
That's true, but you can always take it and use it.
Oh, yeah,
we're
trying to do that.
Yeah, whatever side you're on, you can use it.
Right, and we will.
And oftentimes, and I know this from experience because I've been up against defense attorneys in my workers' compensation lawsuit. The defense attorney is the attorney who represents the insurance company, you know, so they're the defense, I'm the plaintiff. It's kind of like backwards here, but you're the victim, but you're placed on the defense, but you're really the plaintiff.
And for those who are listening who don't know what this lawsuit is, this concerns the mayor's administrative aide, Anna Brooks, claiming that we harassed her personally while we were sitting peacefully and generally quietly, although we occasionally would get up and make a pro forma request to leave a note, and Ms. Brooks would take that request and make a copy of it, deliver it to the appropriate person, and return us a copy. So, I mean, then there was quiet conversation, but generally speaking, often a silent kind of waiting for council members to come and a lobbying effort that extended from December 4th through December, well, it still extends,
And you were continually ignored, and when they could no longer come up with any other reason to ignore you, they did this. But my point is...
Right, they're trying to bar us. They have barred us already.
Oh, yeah. My point is, very often, people who, when situations like this occur where the wrong party does the wrong thing to get the wrong accomplishment, which is what is happening here, they're doing the wrong thing, so they went ahead and got another wrong thing to stop you.
Right, they're defensive here.
Very, very often, this backfires on them.
Right, we're hoping to see that.
Yes, if you're in there prepared, know your laws.
Pass on your suggestions to the Huff line, 423 Huff, and talk about it in more detail.
We'll do. And I just quickly want to say to you that I tuned into Becky Johnson on the air the other night. She was fantastic as usual.
Of course.
Okay, keep on keeping on, Robert.
Hey, thanks.
Bye.
Bye bye. And you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Phone lines are open at 427-3772. Good advice from that caller who has successfully gotten out of a homeless condition by forcing the appropriate administrative authorities to respond in the courts to her just financial claims. And she's now pursuing a suit against Mercy Charities Housing and the housing in which she lives at Sycamore Commons. I know she doesn't mind my saying this because she's actually spoken about this on the air herself. Regarding Mercy Charities, I have some bad news for listeners. It's beginning to look pretty clear that the conditions we warned about at the Dolphin Apartments in the City Council's notorious Dolphin Lee giveaway bulldozer eviction deal, which is happening already as they bulldozed, I guess, 15 different apartments in the Rex Court as part of this so-called low-income housing project. City Council gave $1.5 million to Mercy Charities Housing, and they're giving another big chunk because they got a big chunk from the federal government recently. You may have read about it in the papers. A huge amount of money to purchase the Dolphin Apartments directly rather than do it through the redevelopment agency, which takes the whole thing out of the public domain, so none of us can see. They're holding closed board meetings, which are violating the public Brown Act, which would allow ordinary members of the community to be a part of this process, or at least to see what's going on, members of the neighborhood to see what's going on. But no, Mercy Charities Housing holds these closed board meetings so nobody can see what's going on and claims that they're justified when, in fact, of course, they're not. And I have a lawsuit which is currently inactive but is still there, quite available for those who are interested in this issue to pick up on it, which claims that the makes the just claim that Mercy Charities Housing is proceeding to essentially in a process which involves evicting people, masses of people, and dispersing them in order to create a sort of a little show project of their own. This will be their first glowing project in Santa Cruz, which they're working on. And they have now thinned the Dolphin Apartments by their own admission. I spoke to Elizabeth Vogel at Mercy Charities Housing, down to 158 or 156 adults, that general area. Actually, no, it's 150. I think it's 158 people. And that includes the children. If I'm not mistaken, maybe someone can correct me on that. But this is down from between 300 and 400 people. And I had just heard this both from Mercy Charities Housing that was their current number, 100 and in the 150s. And I'd heard that also and read that in the newsletter by Mercy Charities Housing partisan Sandy Silver and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom newsletter. And I thought, wow, look at this figure discrepancy. Actually, Becky Johnson, who wrote several long articles on this for Street Spirit, first drew it to my attention. And I received some kind of the beginnings of confirmation last night from a Latino man who works in the Beach Flats area and lives there, doesn't live in the Dolphin, but he lives in the area. He confirms people are being told to leave. They aren't being given relocation money. They aren't being given other places. And again, these are just the initial reports. I don't have the goods on the Redevelopment Agency and Mercy Charities Housing in black and white, but I have sufficient reports to alarm me and to impel me to make a Public Records Act request. That's just, you just write them and say, I'd like to get the facts here. And to determine if the relocation agency, the Redevelopment Agency, has authorized any relocation money at all. If they haven't authorized any money at all, and that's what Cecil Cirillo, the head of the relocation, the redevelopment agency, told me a month and a half ago, then what that means is that nobody is getting any funding, at least from the city or the city sources, to move. And Cecil Cirillo said that would indicate to her that nobody is being forced out. However, I also heard from the manager that of the nearby apartments that she had been informed by Elizabeth Vogel that there was going to be some electrical work on a number of the apartments and people are going to be relocated out. So I don't have a lot of information. If you have any information about people being relocated out of the Dolphin, told to leave, please, I'd like you to give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and leave that information with us. We're trying to document what's going on because these are people who are largely undocumented, in many cases illegal immigrants. They don't need this kind of hassle, this kind of harassment. They need what they were promised by Mayor Sugar, by Mayor Fitzmaurice, by Christopher Crone, by all those wonderful progressives who have pushed this Catherine Byers plan through, this Mercy Charities Housing, low-income housing plan through. They were promised that they would not have their homes destroyed from under them and then be forced to leave the area without there being the chance for them to come back into housing, or the assurance that they'll come back into housing, and the relocation funding during the interim while they're waiting for that housing to be built, because the plan here is to tear down all kinds of usable housing and build less housing. It is completely crazy. Unless, of course, it's being done for a political purpose, which it seems to me it's clear it is. The political purposes are those of Mercy Charities Housing and its supporters, and of the city council, which wants a project, and probably the Seaside Company is sniffing around here too. That's been suggested as well. But who knows? All we know is the closed process and the absurd kind of priorities. Or if they're building low-income, they're destroying more low-income housing to create less, and they're getting rid of people's housing that's already there, it looks like they're engaging in 60s-style urban renewal. Only they're covering it in a progressive community by setting up a subsidized project for a minority of the people who were previously living in those buildings. And they're doing so as Tim Fitzmaurice raises the red terror flag of rent raises and rapacious landlords. It would make a little more sense. It would make a little more sense if Fitzmaurice had actually been pushing something like rent control, or if he had been pushing something like purchasing the other properties that were already open, so you didn't have to tear them down, but you could purchase them and, you know, fix them up and actually provide for affordable rent, subsidized, if you want, for low-income housing. But he did none of that. All he did was push forward this prefabricated Mercy Charities Housing Dolphin Lee plan, which is the plan to set up to destroy the Dolphin and the Lee apartments, as well as the Rex Court apartments across Lee Brandt Street, and build a lesser number of apartments and block off Lee Brandt Street, which of course sets the scene for the return of the Third Street realignment, the project that supposedly our current city council was elected to oppose. It's a pretty slimy, stinky situation, and I think now real people are beginning to suffer, real people who can't complain, because if they do, they face legal sanctions. Not to mention being smeared and attacked in the paper as heroin addicts. That happened to Nena Ruiz. That was another story there that Ruiz, who did have a drug problem, but was also an excellent organizer, and her drug problem was known. She actually didn't have a drug problem at the time that this was all happening. And they, you know, there's been no new arrests for that particular situation. She was smeared in the paper by the Sentinel after she came out and demanded protection for the people she was living with, which is the right not to have their apartments ripped out from under them, not to have their property seized by eminent domain, not to have them a sort of a little cog in the big machine of Mercy Charities Housing's Santa Cruz project, for which they're getting millions of dollars now. I mean, it's, I suppose, nothing new, you know. But in our community, it's shocked me that people who call themselves progressive, who run for city council, can actually do this kind of thing. And then, of course, take no responsibility for it except to attack the critics in the press, cut them off when they go to city council, have them arrested, bar them from city council offices when they attempt to peacefully lobby. I mean, it's looking pretty bad. Pretty bad. It's looking like we are, you know, in a banana republic here, or some kind of, I don't know what you call it, militaristic state. The word Nazi or fascist is overused. I don't like to use it. But when you twist the law and you use the police, I guess it accomplishes a similar kind of repression and fear and a lack of democratic process. I mean, I've never been terribly happy with the lack of democratic process generally that happens in Santa Cruz. You don't have a way for citizens to put items on the agenda. You know, long festering sores like the sleeping ban and rent control are just endlessly sidelined and ducked and dodged and lied about, and then the council members get on, the candidates become council members, and then you don't hear anything more from them on the subject. Then suddenly Emily Riley has to study the issue. Then suddenly Ed Porter wants endless decorum before he's going to do anything. You know, then suddenly Scott Kennedy is, he's going to talk about it for, you know, let's talk, but no action. And, of course, Mark Premack attacks the entire liberal, so-called liberal progressive majority, but he hasn't got a solution either. And the solution is very simple around these two issues. Around the Dolphin Lee, you have a real public process that involves the community there. You open up the process to the entire community, and you figure out what would be the best way to create a low-income housing project that serves a lot of people and that doesn't destroy existing housing. It's not a very difficult, you know, way to format it. You do so in a series of open meetings that aren't held behind closed doors. You don't have the mayor and the vice mayor shutting down city council mandated relocation advisory committee meetings as they did this summer. They didn't like what the relocation advisory committee, which had a tenant majority, came back and told them, so they shut it down. They eliminated it. All this, incidentally, is kind of going to be touched on in my hearing on Wednesday, even though we're not talking about Dolphin Lee, which is, we're talking about the sleeping ban, but we're also talking about the mayor's and council member Sugar, who was previously Mayor Fitzmaurice, and former Mayor Sugar's, and the council's acquiescence in a series of illegal measures designed to stifle criticism and target activist critics. That's what's going on in Santa Cruz. Now, I suppose it's nothing new, as I said, but the paper trail is getting so long and so massive that hopefully we'll get some kind of response somewhere, somehow, and that's what the last caller, I think, was suggesting. Again, I want to remind you, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is your station. 427-3772 is the call-in. And a couple of quick announcements. December 2000, I guess that's still true. Bill Clinton is considering a presidential pardon for Leonard Peltier. Call the White House comments line now, 202-456-1111. Hit 0. Tell our president to free this innocent man before he leaves office in January. In 1985, the FBI admitted, "We don't know who shot the agents. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." So said Martin Luther King Jr. before they shot him down. And again, phone number 202-456-1111, and you hit 0. City council number, in case you don't want to do any of that long-distance calling and pay those charges, is 420-5017. Tell them to A, end the sleeping ban, B, drop the injunction against the activists, and C, establish some real democratic process at city council instead of this sham process whereby a small oligarchy controls the entire process, where John Laird and Marty Wormout seem to have more say about homeless issues here than the homeless service providers. It's just grotesque. Laird is a worker in the Emmeline Street complex. Marty Wormout, of course, is supervisor for this district. And they have, according to what I hear, and I believe it's pretty authoritative, they are the ones who pressured buyers, put the kibosh on any change in the sleeping ban for this summer. And still, this kind of Democratic Party hack centrist pressure is coming down not to make any changes or take any actions that might antagonize the powers that be. Well, this is the kind of stuff we have always had to fight about, whether it's, you know, people who are fighting for their rights because of the color of their skin, because of the kind of sexual organs they were born with, reproductive organs they were born with, because of the economic status they're in. All these concerns are still with us, and the sleeping ban is a key and prime economic concern here. And people who are in houses have to worry about it too, because you don't know how long you're going to be able to keep your place. And then when you're out, it's a $54 fine every night. Sorry, that is criminal behavior by the authorities on behalf of a small elite that wants to maintain services and basic survival rights for the few and not for the many. And that's something the many have to respond to. What's your response? Give me a call, 427-3772. I have Emily Riley's response to the Green Party here. And they asked her, "Would you, if elected, move to remove the sleeping and blanket section of the city's camping ordinance, wherein sleeping or covering up with a blanket are in and of themselves crimes?" And Emily, in a written response, said the following, or perhaps this is a transliteration of a speech. Let me see. In any case, it's either written or spoken, but it is typed out. And it goes as follows. "I hate the wording of that ordinance. When I read it, I want to wrap myself up in a blanket and march them all. But as a council member, I would not do that. The council has to work together on this issue. Yes, I would urge the council to change that wording." I have heard no such urging from Emily Riley. In fact, she has not repeated that statement in a public forum anywhere that I'm aware of. And perhaps my producer, if she wants to, can get Emily Riley on the phone and ask her if she does, in fact, favor changing that wording and is willing to go public on the radio. And if she's not, well, then I think we have to say that she's probably not. Even though my program here is a controversial one, and no doubt council members might get flack for calling this show, hey, as long as they want to correct misinformation I'm giving out or set the record straight, these airwaves are a place to do it, because there are numerous people listening, and it is a public forum. So, Emily Riley, let's continue hearing your answer to the Greens when asked, "Would you move to remove the sleeping and blanket sections of the city's camping ordinance?" She said, "However, I cannot promise I would march into chambers upon election and make a motion to remove those clauses that night." In fact, she said she wouldn't, and in fact, she said she wouldn't do so at the second meeting, and there's no indication she's doing so at the meeting on Tuesday or has any intention of ever doing so. So these are misleading statements by her. She didn't say, "I won't do it." "I'm a fan of David Silva and respect his vision. Working recently with David and others to establish safe sleeping zones in the city, I was shown in no uncertain terms that if we are going to change any aspect of the camping ban, in even a small and seemingly innocuous way, we must prepare. We need to plan so that we're not just responding to rhetoric with rhetoric." No, it's not rhetoric, Emily, to strike sleeping as a definition of camping. That's not rhetoric. That's substance. But that seems to be what this current city council and the last few city councils have been afraid of. Continuing with Riley's response, I hope we have a council dedicated to improving the lives of homeless people, not just making it okay for them to sleep outside as if that solves the problem. Again, this is a complete diversion. This is the kind of thing that Councilmember Jane Yokoyama said back in 1988 when she had won and was running, that sleeping outside is not good enough for homeless people. Therefore, let's keep arresting them for sleeping outside until we have affordable housing. It's a completely illogical position, but of course one that's designed to, again, divert attention from that criminal behavior by our government, which now Emily Riley is culpable of and is part of that entire that responsible group, or irresponsible group, I've got to say. I hope we have a council dedicated to improving the lives of homeless people, not just making it okay for them to sleep outside as if that solves the problem. I want to focus on solutions for our local homeless citizens, providing education, job training, and building a family shelter. Of course, no shelter over the winter, Emily. I didn't see you ask anything there. Didn't see you follow up on Michael Hernandez's proposal to purchase a building, to open a campground, to open a parking lot, to do anything this winter while we had the highest death toll in Santa Cruz history. 37, the coroner said, 41, the homeless services center, 45 was the figure a few days later, according to a more less formal sources. But Emily Riley is waiting to get a togetherness aspect to the city council. We can call this, if we're generous, naivete, and perhaps that's what it is. But Riley has been around for 2 years on this issue. She's been to countless meetings. She was chosen by Sugar as part of the select committee to set up the safe zones, a committee from which I was barred, a committee from which all other activists except David Silva were eventually barred. So she was there. She saw the situation. She has been sitting in city council meeting. To her credit, she's come to city council meetings quite regularly. And she actually made her way to a homeless working group meeting finally after the election. And after we repeatedly asked her, she agreed and did come and talk to us for about an hour. And in essence, she was kind of telling us, no, 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 I won't do anything about the sleeping ban because I'm a newbie here, you know, and I don't want to repeat the political mistakes of last summer. This has become the great litany and line. I'm not sure if it's the Laird line or maybe Fitzmaurice has picked it up as his own. And I don't know. I've never heard John Laird say any of this stuff publicly. And I know that Marty Wormhout has killed any support for ending the sleeping ban when we brought it up 2 years ago at her misnamed Winter Emergency Shelter Committee among the supervisors. I know she has derailed any attempt to get action from the very shocking figures of the Needs Assessment 2000 that United Way did last year, which showed huge numbers of homeless people, almost a tripling, according to writer Becky Johnson. And these people, I'm also told, who attend all the rallies and all the fundraisings of the SCAN-endorsed candidates, essentially squeeze the candidates, even like Scott Bugenthal, presumably Ed Porter as well, into backing down from any kind of clear statement, I will strike sleeping from this if I'm elected. We'll find another way to do it. And so now the whole issue has, of course, become a pariah issue. After the safe sleeping zones were shot down this summer by buyers responding to Plantronics and Texas Instruments, who are the large businesses in the industrial zones, their unfounded and bigoted criticism that wasn't based on any documentation, the false media reports being spread by Mike Rotkin, the bogus police maneuvers that herded homeless people into these zones before they were legal, the endless stalling by Mayor Sugar and his committee so that there was no porta-potties and dumpsters put in. The whole thing, of course, then collapsed when buyers ran the other way. It almost seems as though we're an orchestrated collapse because buyers, if the fact that she said no to this gave it a 4-3 defeat majority, but the fact that three people who were continuing on the council said, yes, we want the safe sleeping zones, meant that they could have campaigned for this during the election. They could have said, we want one vote that will let us put this in, and they would have gotten one. In fact, they got two votes. They got Riley and Porter. Porter told me directly after he was elected, what do we do about the sleeping ban? End it, he said. Maybe he was talking about the sleeping ban in China or the sleeping ban in some other city. I'm not sure what he was talking about. But I think we see this deterioration, this irresponsibility that these politicians now have now that they are in office. It's nothing new, but it's something that the community has to contend with. Again, reading more from Emily Riley's statement, we must find a way to eliminate the long wait for alcohol and drug treatment. We didn't arrive at this crisis overnight, and we aren't going to solve it overnight. So everybody can go to sleep, except the homeless, of course, who'll get tickets. And harassment, beatings, midnight wake-ups, accidental deaths. We need elected officials who will commit to the long haul and who will continue to fund homeless services, look for ways to expand them, and help people who are on the streets now to find shelter without punishing them for being without it. My concern for this issue is also why I support Measure U on the November ballot, which will provide additional funds for homeless services. And that, of course, is a whole another barrel of trouble, or it's a situation where a badly drafted resolution, Measure U, which would have increased the TOT, transient occupancy tax, and then put the money into shelter, failed because the businesses were drawn in late, and it also didn't guarantee that existing funding would continue from the general fund, so they could have for funding that was being put in by this new measure and essentially use the money for other things. That is, the Measure U money would have had to go for shelter, but they could have simply reduced general funding for current shelter projects. And so they would have, in essence, had people vote for one thing and get another. And you might call this incompetence by the city attorney and Tim Fitzmaurice and the others who put this thing together, or you can call it another slick deal where they wanted more flexibility, or you can call it simply an election eve deal to kind of get the liberals together because they weren't willing to stand up on the sleeping ban. In any case, after the election, they had a chance to immediately move to simply put aside a portion of the general funding for shelter. That council can do that by a majority. That hasn't been done. It isn't even being discussed. It's not on the agenda. This so-called concern with shelter by Emily Riley and others doesn't stand up to close scrutiny. If you don't act on the issue, you're not concerned about it, particularly in the middle of a crisis where more people are dying than ever before. Ed Porter was also asked these questions. Here's a man who supposedly, and he's very forthright, told the Green Party this. The Miami court decision says it very clearly. It's a human right to sleep. Our law is in conflict with basic human rights, but that's not obvious to a lot of people in the city. We have a lot of people who are not sympathetic about court decisions, so the question is, what's doable politically? I would change the law. There's no question about that, the law of the city. Along with that comes the opportunity of the TOT tax that would provide funding to build places for people to sleep. There absolutely has to be a place. The armory is not enough. There must be other facilities. No reason we can't have places for vehicles to go, except that he doesn't want to say a thing about it. That's, I guess, one good reason that we haven't got places for vehicles to go. My interjection. Continuing with Ed Porter, talking to the Green Party. I've advocated use of the county parking lot, but no political support. We could have a couple of acres at Wilder Ranch. I would pursue it. I don't understand why we're preserving 100% of that property yet not providing for the needs of the homeless. Homeless without vehicles. In our arcane housing laws, we require that rooms be 400, 800 square feet before they're legal to sleep in. But homeless people don't need more than a mattress and a respectable place where they're safe, e.g. a camper shell that is smaller than those official dimensions. We can build things like that and put some facilities in place for daily laundry. Everybody should support the TOT tax so we have the money to provide these various solutions. It provides our best hope in 30 years. So, has Ed called up activists? Has he come to homeless working group meetings we've invited him to? Has he even stopped to talk to us during the 3 weeks that we sat in these offices? He hasn't returned one phone call. Now, that may be because Ed doesn't want to offend his other council members, most notably Tim Fitzmaurice, who apparently is just having conniption fits that we were in the offices waiting there, and of course continued to rant at us that we were harassing the women. Completely false charge, which hopefully will be tossed out. We weren't even charged with it. We weren't charged with any crime. They just used that to get a civil restraining order. You need a lesser standard of proof. Apparently you don't need any proof because we weren't given a chance to respond. But we will, of course, on Wednesday. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert.
Hey, how you doing, Bernard?
Well, you know, one correction there. Ed Porter, the few days that I was out, when I was in L.A., he did leave a phone message, wanting to talk to me. However, he said he would call again, and he hasn't called back.
Okay, well, I know that Ed, I've left him repeated messages. He's been endlessly invited to homeless working group meetings, and he hasn't so far responded. And I know he promised he would call me when I talked to him on November 28th at the new city council member's seating at the end of the week. And, of course, it's now a month, more than a month later.
Are you still waiting?
You know, I'm waiting breathlessly by the phone. Maybe you can call Ed and get him to call into the show. What do you think?
Well, do you know his number offhand?
You know, I don't. I think it's actually listed. If people, by the way, want the city council members' numbers today, they can either call the hotline at 420-5017, or you can contact the Huff line, 423-HUFF, and I think there may be somebody at that line now, and ask that person to give you the city council member's home number, which is, they printed their home numbers in their election literature, and I believe we still have them. Now, they may have changed their phone numbers now that they've won, but maybe not. So,
I don't think Ed has, but I don't have.
Well, call up Ed and tell him that, you know, here's a chance to have a forum. Here's a chance to respond to concerns and criticisms. As far as I'm concerned, he's done nothing. And I know that he made a proposal for a double-wide trailer, talking to Michael Schmidt about that and discussing the idea of housing, I don't know, 10 or 15 people instead of dealing with any significant expansion of shelter like a campground or decriminalizing the people who are outside. And I'm frankly, I'm not impressed. I'm not going to give him points for that, and particularly when he doesn't go public with this issue, because that's his key power, I think.
And you wonder where the Green Party is sitting.
Well, I thought they had a meeting, actually, yesterday or today. That's what I heard from David Silva.
What are they doing?
You know, they should be at the city council meeting on Tuesday demanding basic, first of all, the restoration of civil rights for activists like yourself and myself who are barred from the city council area. We're actually barred from the entire city council complex 24 hours a day, according to the injunction. And when I spoke to attorney David Beauvais last night, he's the attorney who's advising us, he told me that no matter what the city attorney tells us verbally or even writes down, the injunction is the injunction. It says you can't come to these meetings. If we come to these meetings, we risk being arrested and found in contempt of court, regardless of what the city attorney says, even though he's the plaintiff and he is the city attorney. I should say Anna Brooks is the plaintiff, but he's the law firm that is carrying this Miss Brooks complaint about us, which, as I said, is, in my view, Fitzmaurice's clear attempt to disperse this protest. What's your view, Bernard? I know you're named on this injunction, too.
Well, I think I'm getting away from the subject here on Ed Porter. I think that was instigated by Fitzmaurice. If you look at objectively what I was doing over that time, I was very, very kind to Anna Brooks. I know that she doesn't really have anything on me.
Why would they go after you? I just don't understand that. I mean, you are one of the most mild, inoffensive fellows I know. You are very soft-spoken. You brought your son on occasion with you. I don't recall her ever complaining to you about anything, do you? I don't remember.
The only thing that she's ever complained to me was, she's told me, that Mr. Klitzner, these council people, they only make telephone appointments for the telephone, and I've told you that repeatedly. I think that was the only thing that she was ever, frustrated with me about that I'm aware of.
And she was wrong on that issue.
Well, she may be, but I...
Right, I mean, she was wrong. You can walk up to the council and leave them a note. The notepad specifically provides for ways of getting at the council members in terms of getting information to them, other than by telephone. You can come in and leave them a note.
Well, I think you're right, Robert, but you asked me...
Right, that was the only time at which she complained about your behavior.
As far as I know.
Well, it looks like the city attorney and the mayor sat down and cooked this one up with Anna. I mean, Anna is, she's... Miss Brooks is a... I call her Anna because that's what she prefers to be called, and that's what I've always called her, and that's, I'm sure, what I'll continue to call her. You know, she and I have had our differences of opinion as it comes up. She's in a kind of a friction point because the mayor, is in the middle. She's in the middle between the mayor and us, and we didn't ask for that. But she has to take the messages. She has to take the phone calls. She does have an office that has more people in it than she's used to, one or two more people, and that shouldn't be a great problem, but it's, I suppose, us, for a person who is frankly very controlling and wants to see everything proceed in a very specific way, that can be kind of frustrating. And I think, and frankly, that's the kind of person that I've noticed she seems to be. But that's all going to be discussed in court. And actually, I'm going to be playing some tapes now. And I did promise I'd be playing this transcript of Tim Fitzmaurice. I'm actually hoping that we can actually get the actual tape of Tim Fitzmaurice talking to students and telling them why he's doing nothing about the sleeping ban, which is quite eye-opening.
Susanna
Haberman.
What's troubling me too is that in the affidavit, they don't even want Suzanne. They didn't call for Suzanne to give any testimony, and she was.
Yeah, Suzanne Haberman is the other administrative assistant.
She's seen everything that was going on.
Right. Well, it could be I like to take the positive view that she didn't want to be a part of this hoax. But frankly, they may just be holding her testimony in reserve. They can always pull out another declaration. You know, I noticed that you and I think your point is well taken, Bernard, that we were talking about Ed Porter's position on the sleeping ban. We're getting diverted here. You know, that's interesting. We get diverted into these defending ourselves in court. I mean, when somebody claims you're harassing a woman in a public position repeatedly, and that gets smeared all over the newspapers, it's something that you really have to respond to. But of course, the energy we spend responding to that takes away from what we're really trying to respond to, which is this criminal failure, this malfeasance by the city council in terms of endless harassment of the homeless under the city's institutionalized hate crime, which is the sleeping ban law. At least that's my view. Anything you have thoughts on that?
No.
You probably have lots of thoughts on that.
No. I'll talk to you later.
Hey, thanks, Bernard.
Bye-bye.
And this is still Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And you are still able to reach us at 427-3772, and I encourage you to do that. I'm going to cue up a song or two. I guess I read you Ed Porter and Emily Riley, two of our four new city council members' statements to the Green Party. The real question is now, why isn't the Green Party showing up and dealing with these issues? And there's been rumors afoot that a coup is in progress to essentially oust David Silver from his position of power in the Green Party. I don't know if this has a lot of substance. I've heard it repeatedly mentioned, so there may be more substance to it. I hope it doesn't happen. I think certainly on the sleeping ban issue, David is a clear light on this issue. He's he and I have not always agreed on tactics on this issue, and we have differences of opinion there. I think activists have to maintain solidarity and not be drawn into negotiations apart. But David has been very passionate on the issue and tried for many years to get this issue resolved. Still is. He announced he's continuing his fasting attempts on this and to get a fast together on this issue, which I think was, along with the rest of us, successful in getting the city council to take the first timid steps last May when they started looking at the safe sleeping zones. So, I've also got a great book here that I want to recommend to everybody who's interested in the struggle to restore homeless rights or to restore rights for people who happen to be outside. It's called Rising Up, Class Warfare in America from the Streets to the Airwaves by Richard Edmondson. And it's about free radio, too. Richard Edmondson is one of the seminal voices in free radio in San Francisco. He started San Francisco Liberation Radio around the same time that Stephen Dunifer of Berkeley, Carol Denny of Berkeley, and others were working to establish micropower radio by kind of surreptitiously broadcasting from the hills of Berkeley and the hills of San Francisco. And Richard Edmondson in this book, which I'm going to be reviewing for Street Spirit newspaper, talks about how the homeless struggle, he lived in a van himself, and his participation with Food Not Bombs in San Francisco led him to free radio as a way of getting truthful information out when all the media was lying. And we have that same problem here in Santa Cruz. And perhaps we still have the same problem, even with free radio, because we don't know. I've never known how many people are listening to this station, though I've apparently the city authorities do listen to my show somewhat sometime, and I was even cautioned by my attorney before I went on the air today not to be too to expose our entire legal strategy here, and you know, and then and as an attorney, that's good advice. Of course, the problem I have is it's really important to get real news out to people, and I'm always telling people who are going into court situations to try to be as open as they can about what's happening, even though their attorney wants them to keep everything shut down until the day after the decisions and all that sort of thing. Because what we're really doing here is trying to end the sleeping ban and trying to restore basic rights for people. And that is the primary objective. Whether I am banned from City Hall or not is not the main issue. I mean, it is certainly is a main issue, because for any activist, that's a very terrible threat. It means I can't research records. It means I can't make phone calls to the city council offices. It means I can't, right now I can't drive by the city council offices. I can't use a part of the library. I can't walk, I can't use a civic auditorium. All because Mayor Fitzmaurice doesn't want to deal with the sleeping ban issue and is using his administrative assistant, Anna Brooks, as a cat's paw here. It's a sad situation. And in a way, however, it gives us an opportunity to kind of research and to explore what happened during the city council coffee clatch. For instance, I talked to Chris Congleton, and he kind of had some thoughts on the issue. Chris is a man who is a teacher for Bayside Children's College, it's called. That's a sort of a children's school. Children aged 7 to 18, actually, so it's quite a large span. He is also a member of a group called Humanity Now, and he invited me to one of his weekly meetings. I've discussed that on the air a couple months ago after the election, and they were kind of interested in hearing about the sleeping ban, and the more they heard, the more curious and concerned they became, and they went to the November 28th council meeting where we had a protest. And then he brought his students to the city council offices to watch and to speak with the mayor and various council members, see how the council runs. They weren't initially involved in the protest. And I spoke with them in the corridor outside the council offices and introduced them to Emily Riley and to Martine Bernal, who's the assistant city manager. The atmosphere was congenial, and I'm kind of looking at some of the notes he made on this. He said that my students asked questions and received answers from both of them. I went inside the council offices where one or two people were sitting peaceably. He asked to Miss Anna Brooks to schedule an appointment with Mayor Fitzmaurice, and Miss Brooks dealt with him. And I'm only reading some of these notes. Mayor Fitzmaurice graciously and promptly scheduled a meeting for a week or two later with him, another teacher, Linda Esperanza, and a few of their students. And they spoke with him for about an hour, that is to say the students, Chris Congleton and Linda Esperanza, about many things, most notably the sleeping ban and the possibility of an emergency repeal of the ban this winter. According to Chris, Mayor Fitzmaurice himself brought up the name of Mr. Norris and expressed restrained hostility towards him. He stopped himself in mid-sentence occasionally in order to seemingly avoid saying something negative about Mr. Norris. One of the students was making a tape recording of the conversation with Mr. Fitzmaurice's permission as part of a school project. Even knowing that the conversation was being recorded, Fitzmaurice said that Norris was a confused man who was ineffective, doing more harm than good. And after the conversation, which happened in Mayor Fitzmaurice's office, Chris says he stopped in the foyer to speak with Mr. Norris, while my students and Ms. Esperanza spoke with another one of the administrative assistants, Suzanne Haberman. At this point, Mr. Fitzmaurice emerged from his office and asked Mr. Norris to please take this meeting outside, spoke to Mr. Norris in an agitated tone and seemed clearly upset. I was surprised, says Chris, because Mr. Norris and I had been speaking in normal voices. Mr. Norris and I then waited briefly for Ms. Esperanza and the children with her to finish their business with the administrative assistant and then went outside where we finished our conversation. Mr. Fitzmaurice seemed very intent, according to Chris, on getting Mr. Norris to leave the offices, though he wasn't sure why. At no time did I see, that's Chris, anyone speaking loudly or disruptively in the foyer or outside, although Mr. Fitzmaurice's determination to see Mr. Norris gone struck me as extreme. In the course of my conversation with Mr. Fitzmaurice, it became clear that he was uninterested in making what he called, quote, a politically unsuccessful choice to to make any attempt to repeal the sleeping ban. In fact, he seemed uninterested in addressing any homeless issues at all over the winter. This was on December 13th. I realized Mr. Fitzmaurice was more devoted to continuing his political career than serving the community on this issue. And then, apparently, the next day, he volunteered, that is, Chris volunteered to join the coffee clatch. He entered the office around 11, spent most of his time reading, was treated congenially by the staff, looked at public records, found Miss Brooks very helpful. She initiated conversation with him, and he kept a log of what happened. He never saw any hostility. And, of course, there wasn't generally any hostility between myself and any members of the coffee clatch and the staff. They were just there. But they became the excuse that Fitzmaurice used to run to a judge to get an illegal restraining order. That's the kind of thing they used to use to bust unions, the kind of things they used to close down protests, and that's what he's used. That's the Green Party mayor, and I really encourage Green Party members to call immediately 420-5017 and ask Fitzmaurice. I'd suggest he resign, frankly. I've seen him operating for 2 years. But if he doesn't want to, people don't want to get that radical because they think he is savable, I'd suggest they tell him to immediately reverse his position and deal with issues, not attempting to silence critics. Because that is what our mayor has been doing. There's a good issue of Street Spirit out. That's the newspaper that you can purchase from homeless people on the streets for a dollar. It's got a long article on Waiting for Justice by myself and Becky Johnson about kind of the early part of the City Council coffee clatch and what the City Council has and hasn't been doing, and that might interest you. And that's available through 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Let's take that that promised musical break. Oh, I'm having a little trouble getting the proper music queued up here. Still having a little bit of trouble, but hang with us. We will do the queuing. I didn't hear most of Steve Argue's show on Saturday. Steve Argue is a political activist who's been fighting the sleeping ban, ran for city council, was jailed for 7 months on essentially bogus charges, who has his own radio show from 12 to 3 on Free Radio every Saturday. And particularly of interest was the Citizens Police Review Board final report on the only complaint that has ever received an independent investigation. And that is a whole series of complaints, actually. If you count them, there are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23 complaints regarding the May 22nd, 1999 police riot, if you want to call it that, mini riot, I don't know what the proper term is, inappropriate police behavior against a protest, largely peaceful protest, somewhat tumultuous but peaceful nonetheless, which was protesting the bombing of Yugoslavia and the local Democratic Party hacks holding a fundraiser in the middle of all this, with Representative Sam Drop Those Uranium-Depleted Weapons Far, the main speaker. So this report, I think Steve did an analysis of it on his show. I just got a copy of it on Friday. And there are a number of interesting findings. I think it's worth reading through for those of you who weren't able to hear his show. I want to remind you, this took a year and a half to get this report. The main officer under the limelight, Officer David LaFavor, the one who grabbed this woman and child at this protest, has resigned. Again, I'll review what happened for those of you who may not remember, or this may be new to you. In May of 1999, there were about 50 to 100 people protesting outside the McPherson Center on Front Street across from Eric's Deli area, the bank area there, peacefully protesting, but indeed loudly protesting. And at one point, there was a complaint from inside that we were playing, some of us, well, one woman had a boombox, which was playing sounds of the bombing of Yugoslavia, and she sort of held it near the door of this black tie, tuxedo, fancy Dan function inside. And so police came and grabbed the wrong person, is what happened. At least that's what happened later in terms of the court records, that the woman who made the original complaint said, that's not the woman, you took the wrong person. And this woman, and her name is Go Ling Liao, was never convicted or even tried. Charges against her were dropped. However, this became a matter of great concern to people in the crowd who rushed after her as they dragged her off to the police van, or I should say hurried her off to the police van, and people surrounded the van on the street and said, what are you taking her for? The police wouldn't tell them, and don't let, by the way, police tell you that that's a privacy issue. Go Ling wanted people to know what she was being taken away for, but of course they didn't say. And because they didn't say, people stayed there and grew angrier. Well, there was a woman with a child in her arms who was surrounding this van. Perhaps not the best tactical choice for that woman. But Officer David Lefebvre, instead of going to other people, went directly to her and demanded she leave, and then began pulling her and the child away. And Steve Argue intervened because this Officer Lefebvre was using a pain compliance hold on this woman that seemed to threaten her holding of the child. This was a five-year-old girl. Another officer, Tripp, did a similar number with Julianne, that was the woman's name's companion, Almond, who had a two-year-old child who was kind of sitting around his shoulders. And the protesters were concerned that this was a completely inappropriate attack going to the people with the kids first. Instead, there were no warnings given, no announcements made, and it was bad police practice. Of course, nobody ever heard a word of it in terms of the media. There was never an investigation by the city council. The police department was not directed to change its policies. No, instead what happened was they spent $10,000 on an independent investigation of charges around this, which was ruled by the city attorney a confidential document. So I don't have that investigation. All I have are the recommendations of the Citizens Police Review Board to the police chief, who can, of course, ignore them and probably will. We do know that David Lefebvre left the force. What happened again, I didn't really finish the story. Steve Argue punched David Lefebvre in the nose as he was doing this pain compliance hold on Julianne after urging him to stop, and he wouldn't stop, so he punched him. Steve then ran. Lefebvre followed him, grabbed him, forced pepper spray down his throat, what one might call a lethal assault, but luckily it wasn't lethal, roughed up Argue, took him off to jail, and Argue then was eventually convicted in a grotesque scene where half the police force, or a third of the police force, in uniform, on police time and your money, sat in the courtroom watching. So it's sort of the other side of Fitzmaurice's injunctions and his cutting off people's, you know, at city council from oral communication, and Sugar's directing the police to take people away because they bring up a golden porta potty award, as I did. It's the other side of this repressive phenomena where the police themselves show their naked force and the city council does nothing to restrain them. Well, we have this report which came out, and I'm going to read you what the results were. The complaint was neglect of duty, failure to make adequate announcements and warnings, and who did it? Well, they were, quote, confidential. They actually weren't confidential. What that meant was that the people who made the complaint did not say they wanted their names released to the media. This is the kind of misleading form that people have when they file these complaints. It doesn't say, do you want your name released to people who are asking who you are so they can contact you later to get more information. It says, do you want your name publicly released to the media? A lot of people don't particularly want to announce themselves to the media, but they wouldn't mind having their names on public record if another person wanted to talk to them, let's say. But I've, for 7 years, tried to get that changed with no success because this form was written by the police department. And, of course, most of what the CPRB does is police department endorsed. I mean, they have their problems with the CPRB. I'm sure they prefer not to have them there. But they also continue a fairly close association with them. They have they are not challenged in any way in terms of public hearings. Police officer has never been subpoenaed to a Citizens Police Review Board hearing. So there is that kind of close approach. Anyway, neglect of duty, failure to make adequate announcements and warnings. This was sustained. I was quite surprised to see this. That means our CPRB board told the police department, you didn't make adequate announcements and warnings. And it was sustained on a vote of 3-2. Interesting. The board is 7 people. I don't know who they are. And it's strange we don't get to see their names here. I'd like to know who did what on these complaints. I bet my bottom dollar that Jim King was one of the no's, but I don't know. The comment on this is the board sustains that portion of the confidential complaints alleging failure to make adequate announcements and warnings for the demonstrations prior to initial arrest, not regarding an order to disperse for illegal assembly. So in other words, they said that there was inadequate announcements prior to the first arrest, but that later on the police did say, move away from the van or we'll have you arrested. But of course, the people were there at the van because of the initial illegal arrest to start with, the arrest that never went to court. I can read it. So that's the first one. The second one, the second complaint was conduct reflecting discredit. Selective enforcement was used to escalate the protest. Again, the same two confidentials plus Becky Johnson and attorney Ed Fry made that complaint. Their finding was unanimous, unfounded. Unfounded is the lowest kind of. If somebody is really telling tall tales, you call their complaint unfounded. The next level up is exonerated, means there's some evidence. The next level up is not sustained. There's more evidence, but not enough. And the final level is sustained. Then the next one was unwarranted action. The custodial arrest of Go Ling Liao was unwarranted. And people who complained were Becky Johnson, Peter Vincent O'Reilly, one confidential, Stephen Argue, and Vincent Lombardo. The findings were unanimous that this was unfounded. And I kind of, how could they do that when they arrested the wrong person? They arrested a person who was not the person that they dropped all charges against. Or I guess you can say they felt they had probable cause to arrest that person. And that's probably the...
They were being told all along that she was the wrong person by the woman in charge of the museum.
Aha. Well, we actually have in the studio that interloper and the sometime injunction watcher, Scott Graham. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Robert. As I was saying behind the mic here, was that they actually arrested the wrong woman, and the woman in charge of the museum who could tell them, yes, that you can start arresting people, actually kept on telling them, you're arresting the wrong woman, and the police arrested her anyway.
Caller, you're on the air.
I believe it was an infraction that Golling was charged with, and why didn't they just write her a ticket?
Good question. And the answer to that may lie in the latest round of in federal court that's happening between Steve Argue and his attorney Kate Wells and the city attorney John Barrasoni on another case.
Sorry about that, caller. The police are now, the city attorney is now contending that there are some infractions you can arrest people for. And that's sort of new to me, although I've heard sort of they've kind of varied their story over the years, the police department, about when you can arrest for an infraction. But my understanding before the last orientation session several years ago, when both the public defender and the Art Danner, then district attorney, showed up, was that you can't arrest someone for an infraction. You can write them a ticket, and if they refuse to sign the ticket, well, or that's itself a misdemeanor, they can claim, or they can actually, if they refuse to sign the ticket, it's not a misdemeanor, but that means there has to be a custodial. They have to take you into custody and take you to a magistrate and that sort of thing. So, but they are now claiming in this latest lawsuit with Steve Argue and Kate Wells, which involves not this case, but a previous selling a street newspaper case and being thrown to the ground for it and held for 4 days illegally for it, that you can make an arrest on an infraction. And this, of course, I believe, is not been my understanding of the law. But, of course, laws change, and, of course, people's interpretations of laws change. I hadn't heard that this particular law had changed. The board, however, in the case of this, the custodial arrest of Gao Ling Liao was unwarranted. The board believes the arrest of Go Ling was a poor decision. Still, they unanimously endorsed the police arrest, even though, as Scott said, they continued to be told by this one of the employee who was making the complaint. Now, Scott, where did you hear this directly from the employee, or did you hear this sort of about out and about? Where did you?
I heard this at the trial of Steve Argue when the woman in charge of the museum testified in court under oath, saying that she kept on telling the police that they were arresting the wrong person.
So, you still have the Citizens Police Review Board unanimously throwing out, not just as unsustained, not just as exonerated, but unfounded, the idea that the custodial arrest of Goh Ling Liao was unwarranted. But then they give you this weenie addition. That is to say, they whine a bit. They say the board believes the arrest of Goh Ling Liao was a poor decision. However, lack of conclusive evidence and confusion as to whether or not adequate warnings were given led to this finding and to the belief that Liao had been warned, that had Liao been warned, she would have complied and no arrest would have been made. Again, they're talking about Liao as though she was the guilty party. And in fact, according to the court testimony, this was not the person in question. So,
well, that's part of the problem, is that the Citizens Police Review Board relies entirely on the information given to them by the police. And so the police are not going to give them testimony that was heard in open court to substantiate that they made a mistake.
But remember, Scott, this was the one case in the entire history of the Citizens Police Review Board where there was a $10,000 independent investigation.
Right, and I think that investigation concluded prior to Goh Ling being exonerated and prior to Steve's trial finishing.
You know, I think that you may be wrong about that. I think the investigation concluded in December, and I think these exonerations happened in October. But I could be wrong myself. I don't exactly have a clear sense of that.
But I have no idea, as probably no one else that doesn't have privy to this thing, whether or not any of this court testimony and the facts that Goh Ling was released from all charges by the court was ever in any of this.
Right, we don't know. And, of course, one of the whole points of having an independent investigation is to be able to see the process, to participate in the process, to examine the documents, and, in essence, to be reassured that this isn't some kind of cover-up or, alternately, some kind of rush conviction.
Right. I mean, it'd be very easy for them to remove all the officers' names, just say Officer A through Z, and give each officer a letter of the alphabet and keep their names out of the thing and let the public read it.
Right, but they're claiming that the confidential personnel files, the access to those files has meant that there can be no revelation of this report. And for a while, the independent investigator, Diana Christensen, kind of toyed with the idea of not using those files, but simply subpoenaing the officers and getting independent testimony from them at a hearing. But the police review board wouldn't back her up on this. They were too nervous to deal with this. So we had a situation where there was no public hearing, no subpoenaing of officers. Instead, she went to the files, read the IA reports, and the city attorney then said, okay, then it all is confidential. You can't say a word about any of this stuff. So continuing, we're looking at the report of what the Citizens Police Review Board, after looking at the independent investigation and the police department's response to the independent investigation. One would have thought that they wouldn't give the independent investigation to the police department so that they'd get the police department's independent response and then compare the two and see who seemed to be telling the truth, what the inconsistencies were. So they didn't do that, though. What they did instead was they gave this report directly to the police department, the Citizens Police Review Board, and then the police department held it for 4 or 5 months and concocted their own report, which I think was supposedly 4 times as long as the independent investigation. So the whole background of this is troublesome, to say the least. And we're talking again about the May 22nd, 1999 incident where 5 people were arrested, Going Lau, Jim Costner, Vincent Lombardo, Nassim Zarifi, and Steve Argue. And 4 of those people have either served jail or gotten probation because of this whole incident, which could have been avoided had police behaved in a constitutional and appropriate manner. You know, I'm going to interrupt this discussion of this complaint because in the studio with me I have Chris Congleton, who is one of the infamous coffee clatchers, as well as, a teacher, a local teacher.
Hi. Good afternoon.
And Chris, I dragooned you last night to write up a declaration for the hearing on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, is the hearing to make sure that we get our constitutional rights restored so we can begin again the process of trying to get some kind of action from City Council on the sleeping ban. What do you want to just briefly tell us a little bit about this? I know you're kind of in a hurry. You brought us an interesting tape recording, which has to do with the mayor's conversations with you and your students, but I've read some notes that you've made about what happened, and I think some of which may end up in court.
Mm-hmm.
But do you want to just kind of tell us, give us a little summary of how things went, or how do you feel about that?
Sure. So I became interested in learning more about the city council and how our city government works. Just after the election, and I also thought since I'm going to be learning about this, I might as well bring some students along, because what better way to learn about governance or about civics than to actually go and meet the mayor, meet the city council, watch the process underway. So I made an appointment with the mayor and brought some students, and that morning when we arrived, Robert Norris and some other people were protesting the sleeping ban outside and inside the council offices.
Now, by protesting, do you mean agitating loudly, jumping up and down, and disrupting the business of the office?
No. By protesting, I simply mean that they were standing around with signs, willing to talk to anybody.
Standing around blocking the egress to the office?
No.
Standing around alarming and overbearing toward the secretaries, perhaps?
Perhaps maybe just physically. I mean, you are a large man, but certainly not. You were calm and centered and more than polite. I mean, you were everyone was congenial. Even the secretaries were congenial with you.
Did you hear the secretary saying, "Get this guy out of here. We can't work here," perhaps?
No.
Did you see Anna Brooks in tears on the edge of emotional trauma, as she said in her declaration?
Not at all.
Perhaps were we engaging in pilfering pens, stealing food, or otherwise, creating a property problem for the office?
You know, I'm not sure, Robert. I've only known you for
sure,
a few.
You didn't pat me down for pens when you left. Yeah, boy, I got away with
but
that.
But I didn't directly observe anything of that sort.
Did you observe a loud level of conversation that would be such as to interfere with office business?
No. So the students and I walked in to speak with the mayor.
How many students were you?
I believe there were seven of us.
And these are youngsters or oldsters?
There was the youngest was 8, and the eldest, I believe, was 17. And we tape recorded this for a class project that someone was doing. Like, they helped transcribe the conversation, and we just used it to talk about issues of homelessness and issues of how does a city deal with an issue like this, and what happens in different economic models politically, and how can things be done differently than they are in our country, in our city, and how can we make that happen?
An issue like this, you mean the sleeping ban?
It's certainly. I mean, that's a prime example of the relationship between the powerful moneyed interests and the poor. And I think that it's a really strong catalyzing point between the two. And I think that's what I see happening. That's the real conflict I see happening between you and... from my perspective, I feel like Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice is the one who's having the conflict with you, and that his secretary is simply making it happen. That's how it seems to me, because he is the only one I have seen convey hostility towards you.
You actually saw Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, our philosophical English UCSC instructor, hostile toward me?
even in front of my school children.
In what way was Tim hostile?
Well, we were talking to you in the foyer out in front of his office after we had interviewed him. And it had been a great conversation. I learned a lot, and he had given everyone city pins, and, you know, it was a really pleasant affair. And as soon as we walked out, you were there in the lobby, and we began speaking with you. And he came out in kind of a huff, and he said in a like much louder than anyone else had been speaking to you, he said, "Could you please take this meeting outside?" And
actually, I don't recall that we were meeting. I know you and I were having a relative conversation in low tones, and your Linda, the teacher with you, and a couple of the students were talking to either Anna or Suzanne,
mm-hmm.
to try to make some arrangements or get some documents or something. I'm not sure what.
Yeah,
was
I
about.
Wasn't sure either.
Right. So we were actually you were waiting for those people to finish their business, right?
Mm-hmm. And we spoke for a little while longer, and we did go outside.
Per his request, yeah. Although I must say that his attempts to demand that we leave his offices at other times I've completely ignored, because when I'm sitting quietly in a chair, or when someone is sitting quietly there and he demands that we leave, I think that that's harassment of us, and I think he's abusing the power of his office. He's abusing his just his ordinary person-to-person power. You don't come up and tell another person to leave an area. That's a form of assault in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I might tell him to leave office, but that, I guess that's more of a political statement. You brought along a little tape recorder here. What is this?
This is the interview that we had with him. And unfortunately, the first portion of it was accidentally recorded over by some of my students shortly after we had the interview with him. I had left the tape recorder out in the classroom. But what's interesting is that the tape recording after the students had recorded over a portion of it begins